All right, we're back.
Okay.
Puppy is antsy, but let's see what we can do. Okay. So, Paul, what was so noteworthy about your conversation with Paul?
I think it was less the conversation and more his investment in talking to me about, like, what was going on and how I was going to fix it. Because I didn't really want to process. I wanted to come up with a plan, and I wanted to feel motivation. And being he called himself a life coach. He would just be like, Amy, here are the steps. I was an addict. You know, this is what I did. But it wasn't in an obnoxious way. It mm-hmm. was just like, you can do this. This is possible. People do it all the time. Like, let's go. Mm-hmm. And you were like, okay, Paul, like, here we go. I want to do it for you. No, but like, he just gave me an energy that no other therapist gave me. And he came and found me after a group and was like, Amy, you were super withdrawn during that group. Like, how are you okay? And I was just like, no, Paul. Clearly not.
Do you feel like it just really highlighted the inadequacies in your care?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that it was a silver lining. The fact that.
Don't even look at that little fucker. Keep going.
The fact that it was a silver lining is just testament to how pathetic the care was, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, but I do appreciate him. Shout out to you, Paul, even though that's not your name.
Okay. So I always forget that. I'm like, yeah,
I know, I know. But it's for the best.
Yeah. It is for the best. So how long did you spend in, did you call it South Shore?
Yeah, that's, yeah.
This is the fake name for the, yeah, no, this is the fake name for the private,
private hospital.
Yeah, the private hospital. How long were you there?
2 months, 8 weeks, almost exactly.
Okay. How did the rest of that time go? We learned a lot about.
Well, basically, in terms of the trajectory of my treatment, I was up for the first few weeks. They took me off the antipsychotic because I asked them to, and I was very grateful. And then they put me on gabapentin, which we talked about earlier. It's helps with nerve pain, but it's also used for anxiety, and it's not addictive. So, and they said that when I was ready after a few weeks, because generally people do stay for 6 to 8 weeks, so it wasn't abnormal that I was there that long. They said after a few weeks of settling in and starting my therapy and feeling better that they would wean me off the Klonopin. And when we actually started that process about 4 weeks in, that's when I hit a low and I got very dissociative again. Whether that was psychosomatic or not, I don't know. But that happened and I started feeling very depressed because of that. I felt like my treatment was, my treatment was evaporating before my eyes and the progress I'd made. And so when I was withdrawing from Klonopin, I just stayed in my room for like 2 days, 36 hours technically. And I just hid and nobody could get me out. Actually, eventually.
What was on your mind? What were the things you were really thinking about then?
Well, I was like, so this is a funny story, actually. I was like, oh, they're just going to ship me off to a psych ward if I do something crazy right now. Like, go sit in the shower with my clothes on and pretend to drown myself or try to, but fail because I know I can't do that here. Or, like, hit my head against the wall. Like, just the craziest things. Like, how could I, like, knock myself out, I guess. But they really make this this place suicide-proof. Good God, this dog.
He's climbing the walls of the yurt, but we're going to ignore that.
Give me 1 second. So I called my mom and I was like, they won't give me the Klonopin back. Like, why can't you tell them I need it? They gave me Seroquel instead. And I was like, this is great, but it's not the same. And I was just, the same. Nobody could just like soothe me during that time, and I really didn't want to talk to anyone, but I called my mom and I was like, Mom, just probably ship me off and I'll be doomed forever because I can't even like succeed in private care. And she was like, Amy, you're already at a psychiatric hospital, you dumbass. They're not going to ship you off to another one. And I'm like, oh. That's literally what happened. And then
is this when trash can incident happened?
No,
that was a different time.
Wait, when I peed in a trash can?
Yes.
No, that was when I was living in an apartment with somebody. Ow. That's when I was living in an apartment with somebody that I.
Oh, that was not in the hospital.
This was at home when I didn't want to leave my room. No. Oh. I had a bathroom attached to my room, so I was fine at the hospital.
Oh, right.
But eventually I. So eventually my social worker, who was actually the best therapist of all, she was just like on point. Let's call her Lily. So Lily finally came in to find me because people were getting concerned because I wasn't eating. No one had seen me. Like, no one could really check on me. Like, you're not allowed to go in other patients' rooms. So my friends and guys can't go on girls' wards. I'm just calling them guys and girls' wards because that's how it was defined there. I'm not like trying to gender anybody. The two defined wards couldn't mingle. So none of my friends or any of the other patients knew where I was or what had happened to me. Eventually Lily came and talked to me. She like really validated my struggle and my pain, and I cried a lot. And then I was like, I'm going to go out and eat a granola bar. And then after that, I went and performed in the talent show and appeared. Nobody was really expecting. No, everyone was just like, Amy, you're back. And I was like, yo.
So let me just get this straight. You spent 36 hours in your room.
I mean, give or take, yeah.
Give or take, withdrawing from Klonopin.
Right.
Hating everyone.
Yeah.
And then you performed in a talent show.
Well, I came, yeah. So I came out to the nourishment room. They had left. So if you're on unit restriction, meaning you're a danger to yourself and you can't go to the dining hall, or you miss a meal for some reason, they bring them to you in the unit, because the dining hall is a separate place.
Okay.
Across the campus that you have to walk to. So they had like left me dinner and, well, different meals a bunch of times. So I went in and I ate, and then like I was still kind of out of it because I hadn't like talked. I hadn't been out in the world and hadn't eaten, was like, had taken Seroquel and like things that I don't usually take. So I was just kind of adjusting to everything. And I was still worried that I wasn't okay. You know, I was still just like, can I handle this? Like, so I ate, and people kept walking in and out of the room being like, oh, hey, Amy. Like, and this was just like, it was a Friday, I remember, and it was like half an hour before the talent show started. And I had been planning on singing and Wagon Wheel.
Oh, yeah!
A song that I've sung so many times and performed on the guitar. It's super easy.
You never told me it was Wagon Wheel. That's my jam.
I just didn't think that was an important detail. But
it is, actually. It's a
classic song.
It's a classic. Feel good.
So I was like, not going to do it. And then I was like, yeah, everyone was like, Amy, just do it. And I'm like, okay, because I had already gotten put on the schedule thing, so...
Do you have your guitar?
Set list. No, someone else played the guitar and I sang. And then my friend, who's really tone deaf, joined me, and it was really unfortunate. But how do you say no?
No.
You know what I mean?
Not there.
it's just what happens. So, those are the kinds of stories that crack me up. And then I cried a lot. I talked through it a lot. I kind of went back up from there, and that's when I kind of started dating someone in there too. So... obviously that helped, but I really just felt better. And in time, I got off the gabapentin, and now I'm coming off the Lamictal. So I'm almost back to where I started a year later, not quite back to the one medication, because it takes a long time, especially for someone who has like trauma around being over-medicated and stuff, to get yourself back to like square one. And weaning off medications can take a long time.
So, quick side note before we kind of start diving into how this looks on a bigger mm-hmm. scale.
Yeah.
Dating someone in a psychiatric unit, generally a no-no, yeah?
Oh, total no-no. We weren't allowed to be doing it at all.
Yeah.
But I don't even...
doing it. Okay, I'm literally a child. Continue.
There were ways to, so we weren't supposed to touch each other at all, no physical contact. So, but there were certain like places out on the patio in the back where you could get away with like sort of touching. And we obviously hung out a lot, and it was definitely, and there were, it wasn't like, strangely enough, some of you might know this, I feel like this is a weirdly common fact, people get together a lot in psych wards.
Oh yeah.
It's your only way to like, you know, medicate, if you want to say it that way.
Yeah, it's the only good, drug they can't get rid of.
Yes, it's a very good distraction. You're in very close quarters. You learn a lot of very personal things about someone very quickly. And so it's easy to form those connections. You have no communication. You have no, like, screens and other people to distract you. So you're very much, like, in this place, very present in this place. And so we we got together. We were, you know, very clearly like an item. And then we were trying to figure out how to hook up and
consummate.
Yes, that's also a way to describe it.
Too many Tudor novels.
Okay. Continue. Well, just for someone listening, put this into perspective. Having like strong, developing strong feelings for someone without ever touching them, and then not being allowed to. Like being watched and not being allowed to touch them. It's very strange. So we were just like, it's a natural human desire, you know? We just wanted to at least kiss. And then once we'd achieved that, we were like, we're going to figure out a way to have sex. And we did. We did. We, there was a cafe. This was the other thing, the other luxury we had. There was a little Starbucks cafe attached to the dining hall area. And once you were deemed safe enough, they had different like levels that you could get to each week as your treatment progressed. You were allowed to go over to the cafe to get coffee if you signed in and out. And so there was a bathroom that attached the dining hall and the cafe together, basically. And we went into the boys' bathroom together and did the deed. And then went back and nobody found out. But we did get in trouble later on for making out on a hill and got put on pairing protocol, which means you're not allowed to be within like a certain amount of feet with each other. But we broke that on the last day.
Honestly, sometimes a 10-footer is a blessing. Let me tell you. When someone else decides you're in a relationship on a psych unit, when you damn well know you both are not.
No, when you're getting, when you're getting harassed.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, we had some very interesting drama. There were other couples. We had a guy who threw chairs around and had to be escorted out of the hospital. Like, he literally got kicked out of the hospital. So that was a lot. We had just, you know, I mean, everyone's coming in there with these very significant problems.
Yeah.
And you can't judge people because they're, you know, when you're all so vulnerable and so kind of, I don't want to say messed up, but in such an irrational mindset kind of going in there, you're very desperate. So people are behaving erratically and you're like,
I mean, everything feels life or death as well. So like, I remember my last day on the inpatient unit when I was 17, after being there for a month because of some very strange technicalities, some of which we're going to start getting into at some point. This same guy who had been on a 10-foot with, asked for my number, and I wouldn't give it to him.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, hell no. He was, I'm not.
I thought you didn't like him.
No, I did not give it to him. I did not give it to him.
No, but you didn't, you wanted to be on a 10-footer from him.
Oh, yes, I did. He promptly began to rip all of the bolted furniture in his room out of the floor.
Oh, that's so scary.
And threw it around, and literally, that is the sounds I left the place to.
Yeah, that's what.
I was like, peace, y'all. See you on the flip side.
Same, the kid at my place was doing the same thing, and they were just like, we gotta kick you out, we can't handle this anymore. The kid had a seizure right after it happened because he was withdrawing from meds. He's a good friend of mine, actually.
Yeah,
I missed the whole thing. I was hibernating during these 36 hours. This kid threw chairs, my friend had a seizure. They were like, did you hear? I was like, no, I was in my fucking room.
The gossip. Anyways,
it was intense. But where were we going with that? Yeah, so getting in a relationship in a psych ward, definitely very interesting. That's kind of a whole other story, though. A lot of codependence there, but I also really still have a lot of respect and am really kind of connected to the person. Like, this person I was seeing, we both had our significant problems at the time. But he's someone very important to me, and, like, I think that he is a good person, just like I think of myself as a good person who's just really fucked up at the time.
Yeah.
So I actually don't regret any of it. I think it was an incredible experience. I still got the treatment I needed. Like, yes, he interrupted it slightly, but I feel like overall I got so much out of it and I care about him so much as a person that I don't regret it, but definitely adds a little more spiciness to the whole situation.
I have to say, this is fascinating for me, honestly, because, I was really always on the other side of it, looking at it, being like, oh, my God, like, they're so weird. You know, like, I always thought it was so strange, but also my situation was a little different. I was the oldest person there, so I was kind of very much kept to myself. As well as, you know, I was like, oh, all these girls, you know, going crazy over these guys. Like, oh, I'm so different. Turns out I'm also gay. So that might have had a lot to do with it.
This is always the punchline of every story you tell. It's like, but I'm also gay. And it's like, oh, yeah, well, you have to take that into account.
So many of the things I thought were so confusing about my life were easily solved. But honestly, thank you for sharing that. I know that that's definitely something that people are often judged for in that sort of situation.
I mean, there's a good reason why they make that policy. There are people with love addictions, sex addictions. Like, you have to do that. But
you're right.
And there are sometimes you get unraveled with someone for all of the wrong reasons. And, like, there were some definitely things about it that were, you know, we definitely became consumed in each other.
And codependent.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that aspect of it, I definitely wish I hadn't been so lied to. But I knew it was happening. I was just so fragile that I was like, I don't care. I love this kid.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I mean, I want to write a memoir. I already talked to him about it. I'm going to write a memoir about it at some point.
Hell yeah. And thank you.
My current boyfriend is going to have to deal with it.
Whatever. <It's pretty fine. laughs> I need to stop snoring. Okay. So thank you for sharing that. So you spend 8 weeks at South Shore.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for you to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Did you actually feel ready to go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. I was definitely ready. There was, like, not... I think 2 months was a good amount of time for me, given that I had that breakdown in the middle, and had such a good group of friends, as weird as that sounds. We all kind of came in and came out together. So, and we all ended up going to, the same step down place, although I left that because I was not satisfied with it. But even leaving that step down, I was able to get my shit together on my own.
And step down being a lower level of care.
Lower level of care. That meant supervised housing and basically an outpatient. And, you know, the level of therapy you did and supervision you got each week declined based on how well you were doing. That's what a step down is. And I was just not in the right. I moved again to a different part of the country, and it was just not the right place for me to be. So I went back to Hampshire, but I was successful. So I'd obviously, you know, achieved or done a lot of work in that place.
Of rehabilitation and integration into society.
And I was, keep in mind that, like, they're not only doing a lot of therapy with you, they're getting you back into a routine of living. So you're fairly functional, or you're theoretically, you're ideally, you know, you're hopefully very functional by the end, or mostly back to where you were, if you've had a positive treatment. So I was ready to, like, do more, like, get back out into the world a little bit more.
Yeah. Okay. So as we start to talk about the bigger implications from, you know, of your personal story, I want to really highlight the length and stay, the difference in the length and stay.
Right.
And I think in your paper, you mentioned that it was due to something I think called IMD.
Oh, yeah. The Exclusion Act.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how that might explain some of the differences in the length of stay you received, and also kind of how that might have affected the population of mentally ill patients?
Yeah, so there's this, the IMD Act is basically an exclusion act that puts a cap on the amount of days that you're allowed to stay, that insurance, that like public insurance companies will pay for when you get public care. So generally the cap is like, the range is like 3 to 5 days.
Yeah.
But that's only business days. So if you're, for example, I happen to intake twice. Sorry. So I happen to intake on Wednesday. I admitted to 2 psych wards, both on Wednesdays.
Sorry. It's a clinky dink.
Coincidentally, I admitted to 2 of the public psych wards on Wednesdays. And does that sound bad too?
Ignore my face. I just find it funny. Because it's like the exact right amount of time to give you like the maximum length of stay. So.
And one of it was Memorial Day weekend. That made it a whole week. But yeah, so if you admit to a hospital on like midweek, then you know, depending on the state, your state of being, like, they can put you on a 72-hour hold if you admit involuntarily, and then you can leave. But if 72 hours hasn't gone by in the weekday, in the work week, then you carry over till Monday.
Yeah.
So that cap, essentially that Exclusion Act, makes it impossible to get long-term care. But the caveat is that, or I guess also the catch-22, is that you don't want long-term care in that type of facility because you're not getting better there.
Right.
So, but, you know, there's a lot of people, including myself, who aren't ready to leave after 5 days, but also don't want to stay there. So you're in this weird limbo where you feel like the public system is failing you and you're either have to make it on your own or you're fucked.
Yeah, and the initial intention was to protect patients, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to keep patients who are either at risk of hurting themselves or somebody else safe. And, like, back when mental illness was super, super stigmatized and not really understood, the point of putting people away was to keep them safe from society because nobody knew how to help them. So there wasn't a lot of rehabilitation happening until we discovered that biology was connected to all of this and started making medications and then started promoting medication very heavily to the point of where it is today. But yeah, I mean, now it's framed obviously as keeping people safe. And I mean, they can be helpful. If there's one good example of someone going into a psych ward that I like to use when I trying to kind of like play devil's advocate with mm-hmm. myself, is if I met somebody in there who had never seen a psychiatrist, but was really, really suffering and felt like he might be bipolar or something. Psychiatrists are often very backed up, so it can be hard to make an appointment if you're in like an emergency situation. So one benefit of public psych wards is that you can get medication very quickly. And, you know, sometimes they give you what you need and they make the correct assessment and you have medication and then you make a follow-up with an outside psychiatrist and you work from there. So, like, that's an example of how it can be beneficial.
Right.
You know, they're also, they can be, served, they can be purposed as detox places when, you know, someone's coming in for addiction and they need to detox and they're trying to figure out what, like, rehab they're going to go to next. So, right. Some people can have success in these places, but, like, research and history show that the number of people who are harmed is far more than the number of people who are helped. So mm-hmm. that's the scary thing.
And just to clarify for myself, was this the same act that reduced the number of beds that each institution could have? Or was that something else?
No, that was a different law. This just pertained to insurance.
That just pertained to insurance.
This was when Medicaid and the Social Security Act came out. And so insurance was just becoming a thing
right.
itself.
Okay.
That was earlier on. That was deinstitutionalization.
Okay.
Which is very hard to say without messing up.
All right. So we have these two major laws that passed in different times.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we all know that public psychiatric units, as they have existed over time, have always been less funded than their early private counterparts, right? And served a really different population.
Right.
So if we can kind of combine these two issues that those bills created mm-hmm. with the, can you talk a little bit more about the more is better attitude and how polypharmacy comes into play to kind of help even out the scales with that sort of system?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that polypharmacy benefits the bigger players in the whole mental health system. I like to think about meds as kind of a band-aid solution to mental health mm-hmm. or mental illness. Some people really need medication, and that's totally valid. And I, you know, I'm on medication, and I know that it has helped me. It's hurt me, but it's also helped me. So I am an advocate of medication where it is appropriately prescribed.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see it as I don't really think of my mental illness as having a cure either, but I don't see it as what should be keeping me healthy. I think psychotherapy is really where you do the work. And I don't want to be on meds for the rest of my life. And I know that some people do have to be on it for their whole lives, but that's not ever, that was never supposed to be the goal, was to just give some, medicate somebody for the rest of their lives and then not do anything else. And these drugs have shown to have such a wide variety of side effects on different people that, you know, scary things have happened. I mean, people have suicidal thoughts when sometimes they have, like, these meds have the adverse effects. So, you know, they can harm people. And when you mix medications together, you can't necessarily discern what's causing positive or negative effects.
Yeah, and it's not always going to be some sort of synergistic reaction.
Right. So I think there have been a lot of studies that have come out lately about antipsychotics because there a second generation of them has come out that are being used a lot more in tandem with antidepressants and other categories of drugs and have caused a lot of harm, especially in younger kids who are being medicated more in school and whatnot. And then there's the overlap of, you know, I'm also an assistant teacher and I have a lot of kids who really can't function well without their ADD meds. And I agree with certain decisions about which kids are medicated because it does help them. But then what if you add in some psychiatric meds on top of that? And this is a 10-year-old kid. So I guess I'm going off track a little bit, but there's a lot of blurred lines about kind of using meds to make everything move more quickly. It gets people in and out of hospitals faster.
Yeah, increases that turnover rate.
Yeah, and you don't have time to do intensive psychotherapy. You also don't have enough doctors. You don't have enough money. You don't have enough space. So, like, meds solve all of those problems, and you aren't liable for what happens necessarily after a person discharges from that.
Right, and we do know that combined with all of these different issues that we just talked about, the number of people suffering from various mental illnesses, it has increased, or at least in terms of reporting. So I know that in your paper you mentioned that, 21.3% were visits for anxiety, which went up 10% in the last 10 years, quarter of which were first reported in outpatient, half of which were reported inpatient, and mentioning that at least as of in 2012, and that these numbers have been estimated to grow, there have been 1.2 million hospitalizations for mood disorders, 36.6 of whom have to be rehospitalized.
Yeah, so that ERs call those people frequent flyers.
Yep.
And I guess I've referred to myself that way too, jokingly, but so that's a whole phenomenon. That's not like an anomaly. People are used to certain states or counties are used to people filtering, the same people filtering in and out sometimes and being like, oh, she's back, you know, so it's quite awkward when you think about it that way.
Right, so just to, you know, go through that again, we've got a combination of certain laws that reduce the amount of time that one's insurance will pay for care.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a really different sort of mentality around mental health and medication here. In the U.S., the more is better attitude is really definitely a part of that. On top of that, the more is better attitude in the U.S. and just the fact that, So certain laws limiting the amount of care that you can actually get. Other laws instituted early on limiting the number of beds.
Yeah, wait, can I make one clarification?
Yeah, there? Go for it.
So deinstitutionalization happened because community care.
Yes.
Community care centers became a thing.
This was under Kennedy, correct?
Right. And because his sister was very ill.
Yes.
And so he was promoting creating more community health care so people didn't need to be locked up. So when that started, money got taken away from hospitals and hospitals started discharging, and nobody really knew how much the community health centers, how effective they would be.
Right.
And there were a lot of things that weren't fully ironed out as this was happening. So, like, what about people who did need to be like need a residential space, right. Or what were each types of these places going to look like, and how exactly were they all going to be paid for? And so deinstitutionalization just kind of happened.
Mind you, he was assassinated 22 days after
right, and then this. That happened. So then there was no follow up to, you know, and his plan was taken over. I forget who.
Yeah, I don't remember.
It's okay. So that kind of, I mean, and we do have, and there was some success. I mean, we have some important community care and outpatient and stuff, but it just wasn't fully planned out well enough. And there ended up being a lot of people who got kicked out of hospitals because those hospitals closed because they didn't have enough money and had nowhere to go.
Right.
So homelessness and crime increased. And then it was around that same time that the, those insurance acts were also playing out.
Yeah. All right. So got my brain straight. So now we have the combination of those two acts that happened. And then we also have, like I said, the more is better attitude. And something that interesting that you mentioned with the ability in the U.S. for big pharma to communicate directly to consumers.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And then also, as we kind of talked about very briefly, the increasing amount of, I guess you could call it diagnostic inflation,
mm-hmm.
that's been kind of occurring over the past few years,
mm-hmm.
it kind of creates this a bit of a time bomb of a situation where you've got a backlog, way too many people, not enough people to serve them, not enough money, not enough space, not enough time.
Right.
And that's kind of where polypharmacy comes in, right?
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Do you know the percentage of people on more than one medication?
It says it in my paper. I can't quote it to you off the top of my head, but it's information that we could get.
All right, I'll dig for
fill
that.
Fill in, yeah. And this is as of last year, too, so we mm-hmm. have to keep that in mind. But I think there's so many different players involved. So we already talked about kind of medication as a Band-Aid solution, as a way to filter people quickly through the system. You know, of course, it does have its positive effects, especially there are many medications that have been proven to help certain conditions, and there's also addictive medications. So once those are doled out, you know, initially to someone, it can get easy to follow a path of addiction that adds on a whole other layer of stuff. And then there's the very aggressive promoting from pharmaceutical companies, like all of the advertising you see online, on TV, on billboards, and then the fact that like agents will visit psychiatrists and kind of pamper them and try and lure them into trying out their products. So there's a lot of different forces at play. People, because mental illness is becoming less and less stigmatized, at least in my opinion, if you kind of think about it historically, mm-hmm. there's still a long way to go, but people are getting more help and we're talking about it more. So people are pathologizing like everyday feelings, like, oh, I feel sad and I shouldn't feel sad. Like I'm anxious, but like we do all experience these emotions anyways. So people are thinking or like getting paranoid that they need to seek help. So there's so many different factors contributing to polypharmacy, which is what makes it even scarier to me. And I feel like it just kind of exists like under the surface and has more effects on all of us than we really realize. And it's kind of like this issue in disguise, like it never gets fully uncovered and brought to the surface, but it affects a lot of different social issues that we're dealing with as a country right now. So,
and psychiatrists get put in a pretty interesting position in the sense that it becomes, I mean, it's more cost effective for them and makes more of a profit to kind of engage more on, I think what you described it as was the biomedical side versus the psychodynamic
right.
side.
Right. So psychiatrists get paid based on the amount of people that they see. So if they're conducting more therapy, their appointments are going to be longer. And psychiatrists aren't always willing to do that. And it depends what kind of practice they're in and all of that. But that makes it difficult for them too, especially if they're wary of, you know, certain medications. But I think, yeah, I mean, I don't know where I'm going with this.
It's okay.
Psychiatrists are in an interesting role, especially if, you know, they start to see that have the same sentiment of like, oh no, like I've, you know, what if you train to be a psychiatrist and then you realize, wow, I really don't want to be medicating anymore. I want to do therapy. Yeah. I don't know how easy it is to just switch over, because there's a lot of like medical and science schooling that you have to do to be a psychiatrist. So it's interesting how actually the fields of therapy and psychiatry like divert at a certain point,
right?
Pretty drastically. So I've always wanted to be a therapist. I don't want to learn about the chemicals that make up drugs that affect our neurotransmitters. I want to learn about that, but I don't want to be promoting it to other people personally.
Right. And I think a figure that shocked me and thinking about this was the fact that 80% of those, mood affecting psychopharmacological drugs that are prescribed are by primary care physicians.
Yeah, that's been the prescribing of psychiatric drugs, because they're becoming more prominent for all of the reasons we've talked about, are now like seeping into physician PCP practices, primary care physician practices. So those physicians, despite only having a limited amount of training in psychiatry from their general like medical school training, are allowed to prescribe like antidepressants, or I don't know what the parameters are for them, but I've been off, like I was offered a prescription for Wellbutrin from my physician. So like it's very real. It's happening. There is a percentage that we can quote later, but it's, you know, with professionals, the profession has loosened. So people who aren't qualified enough, I think a lot of people would argue that these physicians aren't qualified enough to be doing this. And it's right. Just the expectations are becoming more widened. And it's scary to people like me who have been through a system that really messed up my life. So it's really about getting the information out there so that, you know, and I would never tell anyone or encourage anyone to just get off their meds.
Right.
I'm not anti-medication at all. I just want people to be critical and aware of what the industry is doing, because I've seen it work both ways, and I don't want it to backfire on people the way that I've seen it do for me and for others who have ended up in worse circumstances.
Yeah. So I want to talk about one last problem that you talked about in your paper. And I think this will be a really great way for us to kind of end speaking about some of the solutions you brought up. And that is going to start off with a question for me that I already know the answer to. But since there just simply isn't enough care for, you know, care available for the growing number of people suffering from various mental illness or psychiatric issues, where do most of them end up?
I mean, they're jails. Some people go in, they come out, they get put in outpatient programs. They're able to live at home. They get put in group homes. And honestly, those are the lucky ones. The not so lucky ones end up in jail. They do have forensic hospitals, which are basically hospitals within jails. But those aren't well, as far as I know, I've never actually been in one, but from what I know about them, they're not, the staff there aren't well qualified. They're not, the conditions aren't good. So it's not very effective, or any more so than just a general psych hospital. But yeah, a lot of the people, you know, the less fortunate ones end up on the streets. Do they end up in jail, or, they end up being homeless for a little while and then going back through the system again and then coming back out and trying to make plans. And it depends, but this whole issue is part of the reason that homelessness and like crime and incarceration are going up. And I think we have to calculate that into the situations that we talk about regarding these issues.
Right. And there was a figure in your paper. Oop, bone drop. There is a figure in your paper that mentioned that there were approximately 10 times more mentally ill people in state prisons than state hospitals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean,
but how could this very same population be a part of the solution?
Which, the
people mentally ill that are currently being funneled through our criminal justice system versus psychiatric or mental health care.
How could they be part of the solution? Oh, because I talk about, well, I'm within my arguing that point within my paper is more about creating, I guess, for I've been forensic hospitals that are more welcoming. Creating forensic hospitals that can more easily accommodate and successfully treat people who have committed crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also just emphasizing, because there are a ton of people in prison who aren't getting the help that they need. And I think if we could differentiate more between prisoners who haven't been diagnosed or identified as having any kind of mental illness, if we could separate those populations more within prisons and focus more on getting these people help, which entails a lot of things. It means channeling more money yep. into the system. You know, it means making bed and space available. So like, this is a very complicated problem, but I think that, you know, we would be solving a lot of problems at once if we could differentiate those populations a little bit more and give the ones who need that psychiatric help the proper resources and professionals to do so, or to get it, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, financially, I mean, it would possibly even be cost effective. I'm pretty sure that it's mentioned that the cost of keeping an individual in prison versus treating, you know, the same stay in terms of psychiatric care is, I believe, $31,000 versus $10,000.
Yeah, I think there are ways to crunch the numbers so that you could actually be spending less on the criminal justice system and feel like you're putting your money into a worthier cause. I mean, there's a lot of rehabilitation happening in like certain, there is rehabilitation happening in, you know, different prisons around the country, no doubt. But, you know, there's a lot of people in there who are
rehabilitation in terms of,
can we scratch that whole thing?
Okay.
So using money right now to really benefit and provide resources to the people in there who are mentally ill, who aren't seeing very qualified psychiatrists, or also just think about the jail environment itself.
Jeez, not exactly conducive to recovery.
Right. So we have to factor that in too. And I mean, not conducive to anyone's recovery, regardless of whether you are, you know, have psychiatric problems. But I mean, it's just... We could be more efficient with our money, I think, in regard to like how the criminal justice system, the finances for the criminal justice system and the psychiatric system like merge.
Mm-hmm.
If we really analyze the numbers, I think that we could be a lot more efficient and productive with our money there. But nobody's really doing that work.
Yeah, and that would kind of take something else that you kind of talked about in terms of government accountability.
Right, that too. And these issues do come out in the papers, and people do propose solutions like this. But, you know, like everything else, sometimes like people have ideas, but it takes a lot to get them going.
Right, and there is no one entity that actually... No,
there has to be a lot of stakeholders. There's a lot of people who have to be involved and invested, and it's going to take a big movement to make that happen. But, you know, we got to start somewhere, so...
Do you think creating a singular mental health governance entity would make a difference?
I think it's necessary. I mean, right now the substance abuse, there's a substance abuse and mental health association that oversees administration. Sorry, it's called SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration. And that board oversees all of this stuff. But I do think that those two tracks should be differentiated at this point. Well,
I do think it's possible because we, like, in terms of, like, eating disorder care, we very much acknowledge that there are a lot of people with eating disorders suffer from substance abuse. And right, they have found creative ways to both bring those two paths together and also make sure they diverge appropriately.
Yeah, exactly. So
it's possible.
Right. So there's obviously a ton of overlap. So it's not like I would want them to completely diverge. But I do think, do I think that more resources and like people and time and money need to go into that whole administration? Yes, because if you look at the numbers, whether we're like just pathologizing normal, as like some people say right now, or not, like mental illness is rising and the number of people taking meds and seeking therapeutic resources is rising. So why wouldn't our attention to those, to that issue as a government also, you know, be rising? It just,
there are other countries that seem to be having more success with this, you'd say, right?
Yeah, I don't think there are that many, to be honest with you. Okay. I think a lot of countries, I mean, I would need to do more research about this to mm-hmm. feel like I'm being fair, but I think a lot, you know, there's plenty of countries who are less advanced in mm-hmm. these ideas, and where mental illness isn't as prominent. For whatever reason, there's a lot of, you know, different explanations or theories you could give to that, but there are certain countries in Europe that are coming up with creative solutions to problems like polypharmacy, or who are at least being proactive about stopping it. Like Norway created medication-free hospitals for people who wanted to get treatment without medication involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's a great idea. I mean, why not pilot it? Why not try it? Like,
not great for making money.
No. And I don't know the specifics of how it all works. Right. But it's things like that that I think that we need to be considering. And I know the hard thing is, I know that there's so much political like turmoil happening right now that right. seems so much larger than this stuff. But if people abandon these smaller issues, then like what are we doing? You know, like yeah. we just have to stick with what we know we're, you know, experienced enough with or knowledgeable enough about to fight for.
Yeah.
Like I'm pretty powerless over what's happening in the government right now
right.
in a lot of ways, but I can still talk about this problem and I can still work through and be proactive in regard to this issue. So,
I mean, that very sense of uncertainty can seriously exacerbate any existing know, stress or issues anyone might have.
I was gonna say that too. Think about how many people's mental health is being affected by this government right now.
That, and also, I just want to briefly touch on Argentina, and I have my issues with them. Let's not get it twisted. But it seems that, I think you mentioned that they're putting a lot of work into training a new generation of therapists, right?
That's what I've read. I've never actually been there, but
yeah.
And I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm not very qualified to talk about Argentina at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like they're focusing more on, or they're trying to emphasize therapy, more psychotherapy, and more than just accessibility, also normalization of seeing a therapist,
yeah.
Which I think we're also doing here. I definitely think that we've become a lot more accepting of seeking therapy, taking medication, you know, talking about mental illness, but
I mean, it's better than Germany. Germany was rough.
Right.
That was...
It's... Right, exactly. Exactly. Like I'm saying, it's some countries really aren't doing anything.
Not there.
And they're very much like behind in terms of how they treat their very severely mentally ill
yes.
Citizens.
And just stigma in general.
Right. So I think we haven't purposely, intentionally tried to promote like more therapy. I think it's just kind of happened because people mm-hmm. have like taken a real liking to it
yeah.
and interest and have been benefiting from it. So, but I like that Argentina is purposely doing this for their community and talking about it. Even right. just that is
something.
Is nice to hear, you know? Because we just aren't we just aren't doing enough, and I don't want this whole issue to just be like sidestepped because there's other things going on in the world.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us today, Amy?
Ooh, I'm hungry.
Okay.
Sorry. Oh, no. I guess I just want to say that if anyone out there has any interest in topics like this, a lot of what we covered on here And part of my personal story is on the platform Mad in America. You can just visit madinamerica.org. And it's basically a group of... it's a forum talking about critical psychiatry. So talking a lot about over-medicating, the lack of psychotherapy, and studies that have come out about certain types of medications and their negative effects, et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to learn more about my personal situation, go there. Or if you want to just dig deeper into some of these issues.
And guys, we're going to link that in the show notes. So that'll definitely be there for you to see. The show notes. I have three final questions with you. And these are the three final questions that every guest will be asked.
Oh, okay.
Okay. We're about to get DBT up in here, y'all. God. Perfectly appropriate. Let's get it.
I just like breathed completely into the mic.
I know.
Sorry. I hate DBT.
I know you do. I know.
Don't put that in here. I'll pretend like I like it.
I'm leaving that shit in. I know. Can I get a brag? Something you're proud of?
My vaping abilities and the burn that I just got. That's what I'm proud of, bitch. But also, I'm really fucking proud of my thesis and the work that I've been trying to do. And, you know, you got to keep up with research about issues like this. So I'm very active on the Mad in America community. I hope to submit another article about the diagnostic process, which is when you're in private care and you get your list of core issues and your diagnoses and how that correlates and impacts polypharmacy. Something I want to explore because I just dug up my old diagnostic from the hospital and it's very interesting. So just staying active. I'm proud of my writing. I'm proud of my my knowledge and passion for this issue, I guess.
Well bragged.
I just feel like I just really did just brag.
Yeah, well bragged. That's the point. That's the point.
Well bragged.
I have to say that part. Okay. And something you're grateful for.
Oh God, I'm grateful for, again, very cliche, but my right now, when I think about this whole experience in regard to this, I'm so grateful for my parents because I literally don't even have no idea. They saved my ass. They paid for my treatment. They brought me my clothes every day in the psych wards. They kept coming back even when I was on number three. They dealt with my overdose. Like, they just dealt with so much. And I'm grateful that they could get me to where I am now because my life is pretty great right now. I'm making this podcast, like, get to do it with you. You came into my life, so I'm grateful for the path that I'm now on, even though all this shit happened to me. Everything happens for a reason. I know that's, again, cliche, but that's something that I do believe in.
Thank you. Last thing, and what's something that you desire?
Well, I submitted this. Sorry. If I'm being completely honest with you.
Yeah, 100% honest.
So I submitted this essay about polypharmacy, part of which we touched on in this podcast, to a contest for the New York Times that is run by Nicholas Kristof, who he reports on a lot of global health issues and world hunger and things like that. And he's currently writing a new book with his wife, apparently, about suicide. So, suicide rates.
Is the name of the book called Apparently? Or is it Apparently About Suicide?
Well, no, it's Apparently About Suicide. Sorry.
Okay.
So he's writing a book that he mentioned. I get his newsletters. So he wrote mention in his newsletter that he's been less active writing columns lately because him and his wife are writing a book. And then he, like, quoted this suicide rate thing and was like, this is the subject of our next book. So, something about suicide rates increasing in the U.S. or all around the world, maybe, is happening right now.
Yeah, them shits are up 24%.
Right? Exactly. So I'm really excited to see whatever he's producing. And I could be off track, but it's got to have something to do with that. So I submitted a, well, I basically made it a letter to him about, there were different prompts you could choose. And I chose the one about like, what is the Times? What could the Times report on more? That's like important to you or whatever. So I submitted about polypharmacy. And if I win, I get to go on a reporting trip with him to, honestly, like just somewhere around the world. He said he hasn't decided yet. So obviously that would be a dream come true. I don't think I'm going to win. And it was more just to do something stimulating that I could be proud of and to put my name out there. So that is my one desire, my major desire in this moment.
And so shall it be, or something even better. Thank you for coming today, Amy.
Thanks for that, May.
I know you fucking hate DBT, but we're going to fucking like it.
I'm going to want to die.
I know.
I can't say that at the end. I really don't, guys. I'm really happy. I swear. Better than I've ever been.
Okay, Amy. Now it's like trying too hard. We say shit like that all the time. But honestly, once you've done a few rodeos in the psych unit, it's like not as dramatic.
Not at all.
So, I'm pretty sure I say I want to die like a few times a day, especially currently in the state of my job.
To say in the psych ward, the fucked up kid who made it, make us watch Bad Girls Club, he was so funny. We started making like death jokes, you know, and because that's just what you do in the psych ward. You're like, I want to die. And then you're like, shit. They just heard me, and it's like funny. He'd like, instead of saying going out with a bang when people would discharge, he'd be like going out with a hang, and we'd be like,
too soon.
No, it's so funny though. I'm sorry, I can't. Oh my God. I have to tell that story when I can, but no one thinks it's funny except for me. That's the problem.
No, it is funny, but I just feel like I shouldn't think it's funny.
I hope some of these listeners have been to psych wards and that you can really relate to some of the crude jokes we're making.
Bro, I couldn't keep it together the other day. It was our office fall birthday party, and we were playing fucking apples to apples, bro. I have never in my life played apples to apples outside of a psychiatric institution. So when I tell you, I was just
traumatized.
Fucking one, traumatized. Two, halfway dissociated. And three, could not stop laughing the entire time. And everyone's like, wow, you're really good at this. I'm like,
The memories. Yeah, I have certain associations that I just can't handle. Like, I can't eat Lays.
I mean, have you seen someone try to kill themselves with an apples to apples card?
No, I haven't had that experience yet. Thank God.
On that note, thank you guys for coming on this first round. We've gotten to know co-host Amy.
Yeah, we really got to feed this dog.
I totally thought your last name was a lie when we first met. It was a fake name, and you just hula hooped a lot.
I wish that was the case.
I was also hoping, because I also hula hoop a lot, but that's not what
happened.
I also
always tell people that I wish that my last name had gone to someone who's actually good at basketball, because this girl is not. I scored 0 points during middle school basketball. Zero.
But you tried.
I did not succeed. I do not deserve my name. But, alas, I'm Amy Hoops. Thanks for having me, May.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll take some time, probably dive into a topic that I'm obsessed with. We'll see which one it's going to be. And y'all
have
can
a
get
bunch.
I do have a lot of special interest, and y'all can get to know me a little bit. But
yes, I'm going to prepare my notes, and we're going to talk about May's div. I don't know when, but it's going to be in the next.
Maybe not even my div. I don't know.
We're going to talk. We're going to dissect some of May's life at some point soon. So stay tuned for that, and some other gems coming this way to the yurt.
The yurt.
Or not. We might not always be in here.
All right.
Okay,
well,
bye.
Love y'all.
Bye.